Dr. Dean Ornish is the founder of the nonprofit Preventive Medicine Research Institute in Sausalito, California. He is also a clinical professor of medicine at the University of California, San Francisco. For more than 30 years, Dr. Ornish has directed clinical research showing for the first time that comprehensive lifestyle change can reverse even severe coronary heart disease without drugs or surgery. He designed the first randomized controlled trial showing that comprehensive lifestyle change can stop or even reverse the progression of prostate cancer. His work shows that behavior affects gene expression, turning on disease-preventing genes and turning off genes that promote cancer and heart disease. In collaboration with Nobel laureate Elizabeth Blackburn, he showed that these behaviors can lengthen telomeres, the ends of chromosomes that control how long we live. He is the author of 6 best-selling books, including Love and Survival, and his most recent book, The Spectrum, and has a great deal to tell us about how we can use these simple yet effective methods to radically shift and boost our performance levels. Welcome, Dr. Ornish. I am so thrilled to have you on this program, and I really was struck by the evidence from your prostate cancer study, because it showed that simple behavioral changes could alter the expression of over 500 genes. Can you just please describe that study and what it showed?
Yeah, what I've become so impressed by over the 37 years of doing work in this area is how dynamic these biological mechanisms are that regulate our health and our well-being, for better and for worse, how quickly we can get better or worse, depending on the lifestyle choices that we make. And in our work, we've been using these very high-tech, expensive, state-of-the-art scientific measures to prove how powerful these very low-tech and low-cost and, in many ways, ancient interventions can be. And whatever we look at, we find the same thing. The more people change, the more they improve, and how quickly these changes can occur. So we did a study where we looked at men with early-stage prostate cancer. It was the first randomized controlled trial to see whether lifestyle changes could beneficially affect the progression of men with early-stage prostate cancer. And we did it in collaboration with Dr. Peter Carroll, the chair of urology at University of California, San Francisco, where I'm a professor, and the late Dr. Bill Fair, who at the time was the chair of urology at Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center in New York. And we found that we could slow, stop, or even reverse the progression of early-stage prostate cancer compared to the control group that got worse. And so we were curious what some of the underlying mechanisms that might be to help explain this finding. And we found that over 500 genes, 501 to be exact, were changed in only 3 months, and in every case in a beneficial direction. In other words, in simple terms, turning on or upregulating the good genes that protect us, turning off or downregulating the bad genes, particularly the ones that cause chronic inflammation, oxidative stress, and the what are called oncogenes that promote prostate, breast, and colon cancer were downregulated or turned off, all within just a few months. And just shows again how the more we look, the more mechanisms we can explain why these simple changes in diet and lifestyle are so powerful.
And what were those changes that the men in that study made?
Well, they're the same changes in all of our studies, really, that a whole foods, plant-based diet, low in refined carbs and sugar, yoga and meditation for an hour a day, half an hour a day of walking or other aerobic exercise, and more love and intimacy, you know, spending more time with your friends and family. Very simple. You know, we talk a lot about personalized medicine and so on, but, you know, what so I'm struck by is that these same lifestyle changes, whatever we were looking at, whether it was reversing heart disease or prostate cancer, reversing type 2 diabetes, changing gene expression, lengthening telomeres and reversing aging, it's the same intervention for all of these. And in every study, we found the more people changed, the more they improved in every metric we looked at, and the more they changed their lifestyle, the better they felt, and the better they felt, the more they wanted to keep doing it, because it's kind of like, oh, there's no point in giving up something that you like unless you get something back that's better and quickly. And because these biological mechanisms, as we've talked about, are so dynamic, most people find that they feel so much better so quickly, it reframes the whole reason for making these changes from fear of dying, which is not sustainable over the long term, to joy of living, which is.
Oh, beautifully put. So it's actually a self-reinforcing loop. You feel better when you make these changes, so that motivates you to persist in making those changes. You feel better still, and you're on an upward spiral.
That's right. And it's not because some doctor or some book or some radio show or some authority figure told you. It's like you make the connections yourself. It's like, oh, when I do this, I feel good. When I do that, I don't feel so good. So maybe I'll do more of this and less of that. And it comes out of your own experience. So that makes it much more sustainable.
So you then went on to look at telomeres and how these kinds of changes affect telomere length. Go ahead and just tell us, first of all, what telomeres are, why they're important, and what your research found.
Telomeres are the ends of our chromosomes that control aging. They're sometimes likened to the plastic tips on the ends of shoelaces that keep the shoelace from unraveling. They keep your chromosomes from unraveling. And as you get older, they tend to get shorter. And as they get shorter, the incidence of premature death from pretty much all causes tends to go up. Heart disease, diabetes, dementia, most forms of cancer, and so on. So we did a study. In fact, we did the study with Elizabeth Blackburn, who won the Nobel Prize 4.5 years ago for discovering telomerase, an enzyme that repairs and lengthens telomeres. And she had published a study a few years ago with Alyssa Eppel and others showing that chronic emotional stress shortened telomeres and actually may have reduced the long lifespan of women who were under chronic stress by 9 to 17 years. And we were at a conference together where they were presenting this, and we had lunch afterwards. And I said, you know, this is exciting stuff. If bad things make your telomeres shorter, improper diet and chronic emotional stress and smoking and lack of exercise, maybe good things can make them longer, like the kinds of things that we do. So we did a study, and 5 years ago, we published a paper in The Lancet Oncology showing that the enzyme, the telomerase, increased by 30% in only 3 months. And so we followed these people for a total of 5 years, and we found that after 5 years, and we just published these findings also in The Lancet just a few months ago, that their telomere length increased by about 10%, whereas it got shorter in the control group. So this is the first study showing that any intervention, drugs or whatever, can actually lengthen telomeres. And except in our case, we didn't use drugs. It was just the same lifestyle changes. And here again, we found that the more closely people followed the recommendations that we made, the longer their telomeres got at any age. And so I think these are the kinds of findings that are really empowering people and giving them new hope and new choices that they didn't have before.
That's powerful that you can pick these up at any age. So even if you're 50, 60, 70, 80, if you start making these changes, you will then nudge your gene expression and your telomere length in the right direction.
Well, not just that, in everything we looked at. You know, when we showed, for example, that heart disease was reversible, and we found that the more closely people followed our program, the less clogged their arteries became. You know, the more closely they followed the program, the smaller their prostate tumors grew in vitro. So the more we look, the more mechanisms we have to explain why these very simple changes are so powerful. And, you know, so often people say, oh, you know, I can't do anything about my genes. It's all in my genes. I've got bad genes. There's nothing I can do about it. So it's like, well, actually there is. Not to blame, but to empower. If you've got, you know, bad genes, in a manner of speaking, because your mother and father and sister and brothers and aunts and uncles all, say, for example, died of heart disease at an early age, it doesn't mean that you need to die from it. It means that you probably need to make bigger changes in lifestyle than someone who has different genes in order to avoid that. But if you're willing to do that, there's no reason you should ever need to get heart disease or whatever it happens to be.
I almost think about having your lifeline split and two versions of you branching off. One version of you is doing all the things you've done up to this point. The other version is making those lifestyle changes and really adopting them wholesale. And it's almost like you'll see gene expression changing over time if you make those changes.
Well, not only gene expression, but in all of these things. You know, our bodies have this remarkable capacity to begin healing themselves if we simply stop doing what's causing the problem in the first place. You know, we can undo a lot of damage. You know, my favorite key on the computer is the undo button.
Yeah, right.
That in our lives, sometimes I wish, you know, gosh, it'd be nice if I could just hit the undo button in my life in certain points. But in a sense, that's what we're doing. In fact, I studied yoga and meditation for 40 years with an ecumenical spiritual teacher named Swami Satchidananda. And people say, what are you, a Hindu? He'd say, no, I'm an undo. You know, so I guess I'm an undo as well.
Oh, I love it. What a great image of hitting the delete button and all those things that make us worried, sick, and fat. Now, you know, when I reread your prostate study, when I read it first when I was writing a new edition of my book, The Genie in Your Genes, but then I reread the study a couple of years later, and I noticed one really depressing thing about that prostate cancer study. The one really piece of bad news for me in that study was this. Dean, one of the astonishing things was that to find 30 men who would enroll in your study, you had to interview and talk to and attempt to recruit. You had to interview, I think, was 180 men. So in other words, 150 of them, a large number of them, most of them elected conventional treatment, which has the side effects of often leaving men incontinent and impotent. And they did that rather than these simple lifestyle changes. I mean, I read that number and I thought, this is insanity. I mean, why would people want to take on this terribly risky kind of surgery instead of making these elementary common sense changes to their lives?
Well, first of all, things have changed a bit since that study came out. There were two major studies that came out in the New England Journal of Medicine a few years ago, and they looked at men with early stage prostate cancer. And one study found no benefit from surgery or radiation, and the other found that one out of 49 men who either were operated on and had their prostates removed, or who had radiation treatment, either 3D conformal radiation or brachytherapy, benefited from the treatment. The other 48, as you indicated, often became either impotent or incontinent or both. So we take guys who are often in their prime of life, people like me who are like, I just turned 60, and their PSA goes up a little bit, which often happens when guys get older just because their prostates get bigger, not necessarily because of cancer, but they invariably are told they should have a biopsy. And then because most men have prostate cancer, like 60% of men in their 60s have it, 80% of men in their 80s have it. But it's not going to ever be a problem for them. They're going to die with it, not from it. Only about one out of 49 men, according to this major study, needs really to be treated. But what happens is a guy gets their PSA goes up, they get a biopsy, the doctor says, "Wow, we found your prostate cancer. Good thing we found it before it spread. Now let's either radiate it or do surgery, and then you'll live forever." And the patient, more often than not, says, "Thank you, doctor, for saving my life." What they didn't know is that 40 out of 49 times, nothing would happen. They would die with that prostate cancer. It would never clinically be an issue for them, not from it. And I've been working with Peter Carroll, the chair of urology at UCSF, one of the busiest surgeons in the country, but he also has the largest cohort of men doing what it's called active surveillance, where they can watch them without actually treating them. And we've developed algorithms. We can identify pretty carefully who that one out of 49 men who needs to be treated. They can be followed with, repeat PSAs and ultrasounds and so on, and even biopsies if necessary. And so what happens is that people don't know any better. If the choice is between doing nothing and doing something, and you're told you have a cancer growing in you and you want to get it out before it spreads, it's almost overwhelming the amount of pressure that men feel, both from their loved ones and their friends and well-meaning people, as well as the fear that comes from that to, quote, do something about it. But so, and in fact, the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force said maybe we shouldn't even screen men for prostate cancer because they knew that there's such intense pressure to, quote, do something, even though the treatment is worse than the disease. I mean, you maim someone in the most personal ways. They can't have sex and they're wearing diapers for no benefit at huge economic costs. But we're saying, wait a minute, there's a third alternative here. I think it's always good to know, but then what do you do about it? And instead of, submitting people to these interventions that maim them, to say, wait a minute, there's a third alternative. Change your lifestyle. Like, what's the more radical intervention here? Having surgery to remove your prostate, getting radiated in your most, private and personal and vulnerable areas, or walking, meditating, eating vegetables, and quit smoking. I mean, this is something that I've dealt with for almost 40 years in doing this work. People say, "Dean, why are you doing this radical intervention? Why don't you do something more conservative, like cutting people's chests open and doing bypass surgery, or putting radioactive stents or drug-eluting stents in?"
Yeah.
And the randomized trials. What's changing is that, Dawson, is that there was a meta-analysis published in what was called the Archives of Internal Medicine. It's now called JAMA Internal Medicine, where they reviewed the eight randomized trials of treating heart disease with stents and angioplasties. And they've all found the same thing, that if you're stable, unless you're in the middle of having a heart attack, which most people aren't, they don't work. The stents don't prolong life. They don't prevent heart attacks. They don't even reduce angina compared to doing nothing. And the same is true for bypass surgery. Unless you have left main disease or equivalent and poor left ventricular function, which is only about 1 or 2% of people who end up getting bypass surgery, they don't work either. And we spent almost $100 billion on those two operations just in the U.S. last year that are dangerous, invasive, expensive, and largely ineffective. It's like, well, what's the more radical intervention here? You know, and yet at the same time, we and others are now doing studies showing that we were able to show for the first time that heart disease is reversible. We showed for the first time that prostate cancer, still the only randomized trial, showing that prostate cancer can often be stopped or reversed in the early stages.
Now, the encouraging thing is that your work with heart disease has led some medical systems and some insurance systems to actually adopt that as a frontline treatment. It's so encouraging. Any sign of that happening with prostate cancer?
Well, first of all, it's happening because we spent 16 years being reviewed by Medicare. And after 16 years of review, 3 years ago, they actually created a new benefit category. An act of Congress was passed to give them the statutory authority to do that. And so, and then they began covering our program as a Dr. Dean Ornish's program for reversing heart disease, something they've never done before. We asked them to do it generically. We were just going to give it away. And they wanted to do it as a branded program because they're, you know, concerned about, as we are, about quality assurance and fraud and abuse and so on. And after 16 years of review, they knew we'd do a good job. And so we've now been contacted by literally thousands of hospitals and clinics and healthcare professionals who want us to train and certify them in our program. And we've been doing that through a company called HealthWays. If you go to healthways.com or ornish.com, your listeners can see this. And so that's exciting to me because I used to think if we just did good science, that would change medical practice. And to some degree it did, but what I learned is that what really changes medical practice is if you change reimbursement. If it's reimbursable, then it's sustainable. And now because Medicare is paying for it, recently WellPoint, which is Blue Cross of California, they're in 14 states, 35 million members, including New York and California, is now covering and actively marketing our program to its members. And most other insurance companies are as well. And so that allows us to create a new paradigm of healthcare at a time when all these forces are converging that make this the right idea at the right time. At the same time, the limitations of high-tech medicine that we've been talking about, you know, the bypasses and stents and angioplasties and radical prostatectomies don't work so well, that drug treatments for diabetes don't work nearly as well as getting your blood sugar down with lifestyle. If you can get your hemoglobin A1C, a measure of blood sugar, down below 7 with drugs, you don't necessarily prevent the complications, you know, the amputations and strokes and blindness and kidney failure and horrible complications. But if you can get it down below 7 with diet and lifestyle, as we've shown repeatedly, you can prevent all of those human costs and all of those economic costs. So at the same time that the limitations of drugs and surgery are becoming more well documented, the power of these very simple and low tech and low cost and often ancient interventions is also becoming more powerful. And finally, because of Obamacare finally becoming the law of the land, whatever you think about it, it's turning its all the incentives on their ears. So before, the more procedures you did, the more stents and bypasses, for example, you did, the more money you make if you're a hospital or clinic or a doctor. Now it's more like, here's X amount of dollars to take care of somebody. You, the doctor or hospital or clinic, gets to keep what's left over. So the fewer operations and radiation and so on that you do, the more money is left over. And so on the one hand, Medicare is now paying $7,300 per patient for those who go through our program. But there's also additional savings on the back end because there's less utilization of resources, and so there's more money left over for the doctors or the hospital. So after 37 years of doing this work, our time has finally come.
Thank you for persisting, because many, many pioneers get frustrated and discouraged early on and don't have the persistence to keep on going. I'm just so grateful to you, despite all of the early discouragements, that you kept on persisting. I'm just on a personal level, I'm just curious, what kept you going when, for example, people were just dismissing your early results and treating this as kind of an, you know, alternative medicine is kind of an inferior category in treatment?
Well, first of all, I don't really like the term alternative medicine because it implies something that's not mainstream or that it's unproven. It's more of an integrative approach. In fact, there's a new term called lifestyle medicine that I like, that lifestyle is treatment and not simply as prevention. But, we use drugs and surgery where they're appropriate, particularly in the short term, but it's more about addressing the underlying causes. And we find that when we do that, our bodies have this remarkable capacity to begin healing and much more quickly than we had once thought. And so I got interested in doing this work when I was profoundly depressed in college and found that these same approaches really turned my life around. And then later when I was in medical school and I was learning had to do bypass surgery with Michael DeBakey, an eminent heart surgeon at the time, as a medical student. It was exciting at first. You know, it was kind of an Aztec priest quality to the whole thing of cutting someone's chest open and exposing a baby. But it was ultimately discouraging, disheartening.
Right.
Because they'd go home and they think that he would tell them they were cured. And more often than not, they would do all the things that had led to the problem in the first place. And then their bypasses would clog up and we'd cut them open again, sometimes multiple times. And so I said, there's got to be a better way. And so I started doing this work when I was I took a year off between my second and third years of medical school and just became passionate about doing this. My persistence is probably my best and my worst quality. It's what it takes to, I mean, after 16 years with Medicare, you can imagine how frustrating that could be at times. But at the same time, I was talking with someone else who does a lot of government work, and I said, you know, it took 16 years. And they said, only 16 years? So when you're trying to do something that's really fundamentally altering a paradigm, it often takes a long time. But that's what makes it meaningful, because if it were easy, it would have happened already.
There was a report commissioned by Congress in 2000 and published in 2001, and it was on a topic called the translational gap. And the translational gap is the gap between the discovery of a new treatment in a study or in the lab and the implementation of that treatment. And they said in this report published by the Institute of Medicine that it's not a gap, it's a chasm. And what they found was that it takes an average of 17 years for a new technique, a new treatment, to get from the research phase, from the publication phase, to patients. And if that weren't bad enough, you know, so we're getting 17-year-old medicine basically in hospitals right now. But they also found in that same report that only 30% of advances actually cross the translational chasm. The other 70% are lost. So we're essentially getting 17-year-old medicine, and we're getting 30% of it. The other 70% of it, we aren't getting at all, ever. So it's a system, you know, those perverse incentives are such a barrier to getting the best stuff available for our health right now. It's astonishing.
Well, it's true, but at the same time, I think all these forces are finally converging to make this the right idea at the right time. And it's a little bit like in chemistry lab when you have a supersaturated solution and you add one little crystal in and the whole thing solidifies. I think we're at that stage right now.
What other signs do you see that that's the case? You mentioned these incentives in Obamacare that turn that piecework system on its head. What other signs do you see that this is changing?
Well, as I mentioned, the limitations of drugs and surgery becoming more well documented. At the same time, the power of lifestyle changes like our program is also becoming more well documented. At a time when the incentives were getting flip-flopped in Obamacare, and at the same time that Medicare and now other insurance companies are paying for our program, which enables doctors and other healthcare professionals to create a sustainable model that gives better care at lower costs to more people. So our approach is a team approach where it's the doctor is the quarterback, but they're not really doing most of the work. The other five members, the nurse, the yoga teacher, the exercise physiologist, the dietitian, and the psychologist work together. So Medicare will pay, and now most insurance companies will pay for 72 hours of training, which we divide generally into 18 four-hour sessions. So people come for an hour of supervised exercise, an hour of yoga and meditation, which we call stress management, an hour of a support group, which is really love and intimacy. It's more than just a support group. It's an intentional community. And an hour of a group meal with a lecture. And the doctor needs to be, a doctor needs to be in the premises in the building, but the work is done by the other personnel because, frankly, we don't really learn that much about these things in our medical training. But the doctor needs to be part of this. And so it allows the doctor, instead of seeing a new patient every 8 minutes where you don't have time to talk about anything that's important, to really give the patients the kind of support that they need to learn about this, to support that, to train them. When they finish their 72 hours, then they continue on their own or what's called an alumni or self-directed community. We're getting 85 to 90% adherence to our program after a year, and yet the adherence to statin drugs like Lipitor is only about 30% at 3 or 4 months. So the conventional wisdom that taking a pill is easy and everyone will do it, but changing diet and lifestyle is difficult, if not impossible, is really the opposite of what we're finding.
That is so encouraging that when people try this and begin the process, they stick with it. I know that other studies have also shown really low patient compliance with certain other regimes, and to have something that people actually want to do, are encouraged to do, feel good on, and then follow through with is does present the possibility of lasting change. Where do those patients then go once they've learned this, once they've got to implement this? What then tends to happen as you follow them further?
They tend to stay. I mean, we have people. We did a study 25 years ago showing that heart disease was reversible. Many of those patients were still meeting 25 years after the study ended, just because it's so meaningful for them. Our approach is most people, most doctors, we're trained to teach people to try to get people to change their lifestyle or take their medicine or whatever it is by scaring them. Don't smoke that cigarette, you're going to get lung cancer. Put that cheeseburger down, you're going to get a heart attack. Take your pills or something bad's going to happen to you. And that doesn't work. That's not sustainable. In the short run, fear is sustainable for about a month to 6 weeks after someone's had a scare, a heart attack or whatever. They'll do pretty much anything that their doctor or nurse tells them to do for about 4 to 6 weeks. But then they tend to go back to their old patterns because fear is not sustainable in politics or in medicine or in anything. It's too scary to think about. I mean, we all know we're going to die, but it's not something most people want to think about very much because it's too scary. So even if someone is paying for their Lipitor, or even if they have no side effects, they're not taking it because it's take this pill today to prevent something really bad, like a heart attack or stroke from happening, maybe 10 or 20 years down the road that you don't want to think about. So you stop taking it because they don't make you feel better. But again, because these biological mechanisms are so dynamic, when people make big enough changes in their diet and lifestyle, most people find that they feel so much better so quickly. It reframes the reason for making these changes from fear of dying, which is not sustainable, to joy of living, which is.
I so appreciate the way you use the word love and joy and terms like that. And it's odd that those are not part of the medical lexicon. But what your work is showing is that these emotional changes, these lifestyle changes, actually can be thought of as epigenetic signals to our cells because they're literally shifting our patterns of gene expression. And if this were a drug, it would be malpractice to fail to prescribe it. I mean, it's amazing to hear these words, hear these concepts, and then think of this as actually an epigenetic influence that is instructing your cells in your body to produce certain things and not produce other neurotransmitters, hormones, whatever, and reframing the debate in terms of those kinds of invisible and emotional factors is such a delightful change to me.
Well, it's true, and part of the value of research is that
It quantifies that
it
change.
quantifies that, and it gives people new choices, new hope, and new choices that they didn't have before. People say, "Oh, lifestyle, that's kind of boring. What could that be? How, it's a laser that's going to be powerful. It's a new surgical technique. It's a new drug that's really powerful." And so we're using these very high-tech, expensive, state-of-the-art scientific measures to prove how powerful these very simple and low-tech and low-cost interventions can be. I mean, as you mentioned, we found that over 500 genes were changed in just 3 months. But when it changes your genes, you're actually passing along those improved genes, if you will, to your progeny, to your kids. That's the epigenetic part. And so it's very motivating for people to know that, that these lifestyle changes, they not only are helping them, are helping their kids as well, and also helping the planet. What's good for you is good for the planet. What's personally sustainable is globally sustainable. It turns out that more global warming is caused by livestock consumption than all forms of transportation combined.
Yes.
And it's so easy to feel overwhelmed by, oh God, what can I do as one person? And if you realize that something as fundamental as what you put in your mouth every day, not only helps you, but it helps the planet, that makes it meaningful. And if it's meaningful, then it's sustainable.
Have you made any attempt, or has anyone else made any attempt, to isolate the efficacy of the discrete elements of your program? For example, how much of it is due to the meditation practice, how much to the exercise, how much to the diet?
We get asked that question a lot, and I think what we found was that it varies. I mean, as a whole, when we have an a priori determined formula to look at adherence, the more people change, the more they improved. In every metric we looked at any age, which is a very empowering, hopeful message to give people. But in terms of the relative contribution of each component, it varies.
Yes.
For somebody who's really stressed out but eats pretty well, the stress management is going to be more important. But it's this myth that you can isolate them anyway, because You may think you're just changing one thing, but you're never just changing one thing when you're dealing with people. You may say, okay, we're just going to do exercise alone. But you're not just doing exercise alone. You're generally putting them in a group of people exercising. The group itself has benefits. You're empowering them with a sense of self-efficacy and things that they can do for themselves. That has benefit. When you start to exercise, many people become more aware of their bodies, so they become more aware of how they're eating. And so rather than trying to sort this out in a way that really I think can't be done anyway, we're saying, look, all these things, they're all good for you. They're all free. You know, it's less expensive to live and eat this way. So why not do everything that's going to give you the best chance of doing it? Now, at the same time, I wrote a book called The Spectrum, which was a New York Times bestseller a few years ago, that was based on the idea that the more you change, the more you improve. Because so often, you know, if you get on a diet, chances are you're going to get off it, because diets are all about what you can't have and what you must do. And sooner or later, people get tired of feeling deprived, and so they get off it, and then they feel guilt and shame and humiliation, all those toxic emotions. So I said, look, instead of doing it that way, just say, and once you categorize foods as being good or bad, it's a very small step to saying I'm a bad person because I eat bad food. And at that point, might as well just, finish the pint of ice cream or whatever you're doing. So I said, look, instead of calling foods good or bad, just say foods aren't good or bad, but some are healthier than others. And so instead of saying, eat this and never eat that, just say, look, group five are the least healthy foods. Group one are the most healthy foods. You decide how much you want to change, how quickly, how fast, how many things. We'll support that degree of change and we'll track it. And if that's enough to accomplish your goals, great. If not, you can do more. So like, let's say somebody wants to lose 10 pounds or lower their cholesterol by 50 points or whatever it is. You say, what are you eating now? Where are you on this food spectrum? Well, I'm eating mostly unhealthy group four and five foods. Okay, how much are you willing to change? Well, I'm not ready to go all the way to a plant-based diet, but I'll eat more groups one, you know, plant-based and two and three and less four and five. Okay, how much are you exercising now? Well, not much. How much are you willing to do? Well, I'll walk 10 minutes a day. How much yoga and meditation are you doing? Well, I'm not. How much are you willing to do? Well, maybe I'll meditate 10 minutes a day and I'll spend more time with my friends and family. Okay, great. So after a month, let's say you wanted to lose 10 pounds, but you lost six, or you wanted to get your cholesterol level down 50 points and it came down 30 or whatever. You say, well, good. Look, you're moving in the right direction. Now all you got to do is move a little bit more and you'll go the rest of the way. But it's a very compassionate approach because you can't fail. If you indulge yourself one day, it doesn't mean you failed or you cheated or you got off the program, any of those kind of negative things. Just eat healthier the next. You don't have time to exercise one day, do a little more the next. You get the idea. It's something that it's much more sustainable because there's no diet to get on. There's no diet to get off.
And there's no rigid program you have to follow, and that often is what makes people fail. They try a rigid program, they don't succeed, that gives them negative feedback, they drop off, and then all benefit is lost. What you're saying is that with this graduated program, you simply adopt whatever works for your lifestyle, your needs, your ability to change, feel the results, and then that alone might encourage you to do more.
Well, that's the whole idea, is that there's no point in giving up something that you enjoy unless you get something back that's better and quickly. And when you make these changes, you generally feel so much better that you want to keep doing them, not out of fear or because somebody told you. I mean, even more than being healthy, people want to feel free and in control. You know, it goes, sometimes when I lecture, I say it goes back to the first dietary intervention when God said, don't eat the apple, and that didn't go so well. And that was God talking, you know. So I'm saying, you know, instead of telling people do this and don't do that and eat this and, you know, all that kind of stuff, it just doesn't work that way. It's much better to just say, to the degree you make these changes, there's a corresponding benefit, but it's not all or nothing. Now, if you're trying to reverse a life-threatening illness, in the pound of cure, that requires more change than if you're just trying to lose a few pounds. That's why we were the first to prove that, because people didn't go far enough. But if you are willing to make any change to the degree that you're doing that, if you're not trying to reverse a life-threatening illness, there's a corresponding benefit.
Now, if we take the benefits and these practices, and say somebody wanted to perform at peak and wanted to take this as far as it can go, not necessarily to excess, but if somebody wanted to really maximize the benefits to their health, their longevity, their energy levels, and so on, just how far can we take these kinds of practices?
In what sense?
Well, First of all, for example, in that Blackburn study where she showed that you can lengthen telomeres by doing this, how much, at least theoretically, could you lengthen them if you did all of these things? How good can you feel? How much influence can you have on your longevity?
Well, we found in our study that telomeres were lengthened by about 10%, so that would translate into several years of additional life. But we're still all going to die. The question is, to me, not how long we live, but really how well we live. And most people find that they feel so much better when they make these changes. That's ultimately what makes them sustainable. I saw a cartoon recently of Ray Kurzweil, who's talking about how he wants to transfer his brain into a robot and live forever. And it showed him as a robot brain, as a robot slave, and to a bunch of other robots, So you have to be careful what you wish for. Longevity in and of itself is not necessarily a good goal unless you have quality of life. And that's what happens when people make these changes. They start to not only live longer, but they feel better. Their biological age goes down at the same time that their chronological age is going up. And so, what the limits of that, clearly we're all going to die. We're not being immortal, but it's more squaring the curve, instead of this chronic decline as you get older, it's more like you live a full, happy, healthy, joyful, vibrant life, and then you die. It's not like this slow, steady decline over a period of many years.
Yes, my wife's one of her favorite sayings is "Happy, health, healthy, happy, healthy, happy, healthy, dead."
I like that.
I love the concept of health span rather than lifespan. What
That's
is
right.
your healthy lifespan? It's a very powerful concept that we can apply and ask ourselves how we can would encourage that. Dean, as we're leaving the interview here, any last words, pieces of advice, and also a sense of what people can do immediately to shift and implement in their lives?
Well, start where you are. I mean, if you go to our website, it's Ornish, ORNISH.com. Everything on there is free. There's downloadable meditations and cooking videos and how to do yoga and meditation. There's an online community called Feel the Love. So everything's right there. And I designed this in such a way that it doesn't cost anything. There's no special equipment. There's no high-tech stuff you have to do. It's all doable and achievable. And start where you are. Some people find that it's easier to make gradual changes. And as you start to make changes and as you start to feel better, then you want to do more. Other people find that it's better to just make a lot of changes at the same time because then they feel so much dramatically improved, then that makes it more sustainable. But whatever you do, I think one of the keys is to do it with a support group, to have a friend, to do it with your lover, your spouse, your family, your friends, whatever it happens to be, because then it's much more sustainable if you're doing it with other people.
Yeah, in fact, in the interview as part of the series with Malcolm Gladwell, who wrote the books Blink, The Tipping Point, and other books like that, I asked him what his focus is, his current focus is, and he said it's social support. He thinks that social support plays an enormous role in various aspects of wellness, and he think that's what really with leading edge is. So I'm so interested that you've also found that social support is a vital part of making these lifestyle changes stick.
Well, I wrote a book about this back in 1998. What is that, 16 years ago, or 18 years ago now, I guess. Wow, long time. And it was called Love and Survival. And it was reviewing it, what at that time were hundreds of studies, now thousands of studies, showing that people who are lonely and depressed and isolated are 3 to 10 times more likely to get sick and die prematurely than those who have a strong sense of love and connection and community. And in part because you're more likely to abuse yourself, in part through mechanisms we don't fully understand. More recently, Nicholas Christakis at Harvard found that if your friends are obese, you're 45% more likely to be obese yourself. If your friends' friends are obese, it's 25% more likely. And if it's your friends' friends' friends that's obese, you're 10% more likely to be obese, even if you've never met them. That's how interconnected we are. And so anything that brings you together, our support groups aren't just support groups in terms of helping people stay on the diet and so on, or exchanging recipes or shopping tips. It's more of a sacred, safe community where people can let down their emotional defenses and just be authentic and talk about what's really going on in their lives without fear that somebody's going to make fun of them or judge them or reject them. And it's so meaningful for them. It's the part of our program people often have the most apprehension about because they don't understand it. But once they get into it, within a day or two, it's often the most meaningful part of the program because it's something that we're, with the breakdown of the usual social networks, many people don't have a an extended family or a neighborhood with two or three generations of people or a church or synagogue they go to regularly or any of those kinds of things that are a job that feels secure that used to give them that sense of stability. That's why Facebook has, you know, 1.5 billion people on it. It's not the most intimate of life experiences, but even a little bit of intimacy is really meaningful and more than most people are getting.
Yes, absolutely. Well, thanks for providing that resource. And I'm just curious, in closing, where you're going next. What are your current research interests, and where do you see yourself moving as you take this research and these insights to the next step?
Well, last summer, we began partnering with a company called HealthWays. You go to healthways.com. They're the leading wellness and disease management company and so on. And because we've been contacted by, as I mentioned, thousands of people who want us to help train and certify them in our program, we're working with them. And so we've trained everyone from Beth Israel Medical Center, New York. We just trained UCLA, the Cleveland Clinic, and many others. We're in the process of really creating a new paradigm of healthcare by training people in this way. But also one of the reasons I'm working with HealthWays is because of their integrity. We're collecting data on every patient who goes through our program. So we'll be able to have data on hundreds of thousands, ultimately millions of people who are transforming their lives. So we can do some amazing large-scale, interesting research studies at a fraction of the cost, because the major cost of doing these large-scale studies is the intervention, which is now covered by Medicare and most other insurance companies. And so for a relatively small amount of additional funding, we can collect data, which will allow us to really substantiate to a degree that we've never had possible just how powerful these very simple techniques are. It's really the emergence of lifestyle medicine as a new paradigm.
Well, thank you for directing your passion in such an incredibly useful way. And thanks for both bringing in science and bringing in that emphasis on love and connection. I'm so deeply grateful for your work, and I so appreciate what you're doing, the way you're inspiring so many people to follow suit. So every appreciation for what you're doing, and may it long continue.
Thank you, and I have deep appreciation for you as well. Having seen what a powerful difference these simple changes can make, I'm so grateful for the chance to share this information with your listeners and hope that it's helpful to them.
Dean, all the best, and thanks again.
You too. Take care.
Wasn't that an amazing interview, just stuffed with practical, life-changing information you can apply to your own health and well-being? If you'd like to upgrade to the premium package that has a transcript of this call with Dean Ornish and also links to all the resources he mentioned, please go ahead and click upgrade on your screen. Now let's prepare for the next amazing interview in the Peak Potential series.